Well, welcome once again to Why Should We Care About the Indo-Pacific, brought to you by our producer, IEJ Media, and our great sponsors at Bauer Group Asia. We'll talk more about them later on. I'm the former military officer, Ray Powell. Over there, you see the former diplomat, Jim Caruso. Jim, how are you?
All good here in Arizona. Thank you, Ray. And today we have a guest who has a long, distinguished career in the Singapore Foreign Ministry. Permanent representative to the United Nations in New York, ambassador to Moscow, which I didn't realize, which explains a lot, and permanent secretary of the foreign ministry. And I can tell you, as a former American diplomat, every American diplomat that goes through Singapore stops to see Bilahari, because Bilahari sees things and says it clear and direct and with a slightly different look, which is really useful. So Bilahari, welcome. So good to see you.
Well, thank you for having me on your podcast.
Great. Glad to have you. All right, we'll jump right into it. So you've written a couple of articles lately for the Foreign Affairs especially. And so the point of your article is basically, why should we care about Donald Trump's America First policy? Why should Asians care?
Well, we must care about American policy regardless of who sits in the White House. Because America has provided the foundation of stability on which Asian prosperity rests. I think that's just a fact, right? But by the same token, there is only one America. And therefore, regardless of who sits in the White House, we'll have to work with that person, right? And I think it is pointless to, gnash your teeth and, rend your clothes and wring your hands in despair just because you don't like the person who sits in the White House. That is a reality that you have to find a way of working with. And I think we can. We have in the first Trump administration, and we will in the second Trump administration. I think that's a very fundamental point, that I don't think Mr. Trump... Oh, let me step back one step. I think generally speaking, whether we are diplomats or we are journalists, we are business people, we tend to respond far too much to events because we must, and not enough to the processes in which events are necessarily embedded. And I think Donald Trump, he has a unique personality, of course, but that personality is not the best way of understanding the America that we now have to work with. After the end of the Cold War, America faces no existential threat in the world. Russia is extremely dangerous and is an existential threat to Ukraine and perhaps some of the more eastern members of the EU. But it's not an existential threat to America, not any more than it was. Secondly, China is a formidable competitor despite all its problems, and they are legion, Chinese problems, I mean. It is a formidable competitor, but it is not an existential threat. And North Korea and Iran, their capability for mischief in their own region should never be underestimated, but they do not pose an existential threat to America. Therefore, after the end of the Cold War, there is absolutely no reason why America, to quote JFK, at the height of the Cold War, there's no reason for America to bear any burden and pay any price to uphold international order. It was its time, in other words, to put America first. I understand that. Every country puts itself first in foreign policy. You know that, right? But for many years, from Pearl Harbor, shall we say, to 1989, 1991, when either the Berlin Wall came down or the Soviet Union imploded, America did face existential threats from fascism in Europe, from a very aggressive militarism in Japan, and after that, from the Soviet Union. Right? So you were forced to engage the world in different terms. It was a different style of leadership that responded to the challenges of the time. In fact, if I look back, all American presidents since Bill Clinton, post-Cold War American presidents, to me, their foremost priorities were always domestic. George W. Bush was a kind of exception because of 9/11. So where Mr. Trump differs from
Sorry. Because I want to kind of, you were talking about the post-Cold War order, and we have come in the foreign policy community to refer to it as the rules-based order, the liberal order. And in your article, you talk about how Asia, much of Asia, views that liberal order with ambivalence. And when Asians talk about a rules-based order, it tends to carry a different meaning than it does in the West. Can you tell us what you mean by that? What is the Asian meaning of a rules-based order? And is a rules-based order important to Asians?
Yeah, I think a rules-based order is important. But, you know, the question always arises, whose rules? How do you interpret those rules? Which rules you place emphasis on? Now, we may use the same words, and I think most of Asia does use those words, rules-based order, but we may not mean exactly the same thing. I think, Asia is an extremely diverse place, but I think that broad statement that we use the same words but we don't exactly mean the same thing holds across this vast and diverse continent. I just talk about Singapore, right? As an example. When we talk about rules-based order, we place far more emphasis on the economic rules than the political rules. And when we talk about the political rules, we place far more emphasis on the rules that govern relations between states. That's why we took a strong stance against the Russian invasion of Ukraine, for example. But we disagree with interpretations of that rules that say that because you have these rules, I, country A or B or C, have a right to interfere or to have a say in how you order your internal affairs. On that respect, I think much of Asia, not all of Asia, would be, their basic attitudes would be much more aligned with China. So we may use the same words, but we place different emphasis on different words, on different rules. And even when we talk about the same rules, we may interpret them in different ways. And I think that's just a fact.
Is this related to values when we talk about sharing values? And we don't really share...
Yeah, we share some values. We share some values. For example, I think most of Asia, minus China and North Korea, would believe in democracy as a value, but we have different versions of democracy. Right? Our version of democracy, I mean, in America, the right to free speech is near absolute. If you have a hierarchy of values, that will be at the very top or close to the top. But in a country that is a multiracial country, a multi-religious country, and a small place like Singapore, we cannot place we do believe in free speech, but we believe in clear limitations to free speech. You can't use your right to free speech to denigrate another religion, to denigrate another ethnic group. That is one sure way to get into trouble. So some of the things that are the day-to-day discourse in America will get you into serious trouble in Singapore and some other countries in Asia. And I think this is just a fact.
So you also say in your article that some of Trump's actions during his first term suggest that his emphasis on peace through strength aligns with the instincts of many Asian governments. What is it about peace through strength that appeals to or aligns with Asian instincts?
Well, first of all, the kinds of challenges or threats, and I'm talking about the geopolitical domain here, not so much economics. We can talk about that later if you like. Whether it's the maritime disputes in the East China Sea or the South China Sea or the Taiwan Straits or in the Himalayas in the case of India, these are what I would call hard power issues. And you can only deal with these issues with strong deterrence, complemented by diplomacy, of course. Deterrence and diplomacy complement each other. I think any diplomat knows this. So you can't do it by making nice speeches, or you can't do it by appealing to a rules-based order, because different people have different rules, or different interpretations of rules. So you need to have that foundation of strong deterrence. And I think Mr. Trump does understand that, maybe instinctively. For example, I think he dealt with North Korea much better than his predecessor, Mr. Obama, who basically did nothing for 8 years and called it strategic patience. But strategic patience was so patient, it allowed North Korea to develop a nuclear capability and a missile capability. And of course, Kim Jong-un got somewhat carried away at one point and started to threaten Guam. And in response, Mr. Trump threatened to rain fire and fury on Pyongyang. And since that time, as far as I've been able to determine, I've been following this pretty closely, North Korea has never tested a long-range missile on any trajectory that brings it anywhere near Guam. So that's deterrence. I mean, deterrence in its purest sense. I know deterrence theorists are the scholastic scholars of the 21st century rather than medieval times. They like to have fine distinctions between different types of deterrence. But in essence, it's a very simple concept. If you do this, I will kill you. If you believe me, you won't do it. Right? And I think Mr. Trump kind of understood that.
So where do you see what he's done recently, right?
You just look at what he's done recently. His foreign policy so far, and it's not even been 2 months, or just about 2 months, all right? But look at what I just read this morning before I logged on to talk to you, that BlackRock has cut a deal to buy the two ports in Panama Canal. His foreign policy is in the venerable tradition of brandishing a big stick. We may not like it, but it seems to work so far.
I don't think anyone has ever accused Donald Trump of speaking softly, though.
No. But he might think he was speaking softly. I don't know.
But so if we're working on interest then, and common interest, where do you see the congruence of interest between U.S. and, say, Singapore?
First of all, I think we have an interest in maintaining a balance of power, overall balance of power in the Indo-Pacific or in the Asia-Pacific. And I don't expect, Singapore has a very close defense and security relationship with the U.S. But we are not a treaty ally of the U.S. At one time, you offered to make us, what is the term, major non-NATO ally. And we thought about it for a little while and we said to you, we are not worthy. But we settle on the word partner, right? Because we never have expected you to spend blood or treasure to defend us, right? We only rely on the U.S. to do two things which we think is in your interest too. One is to maintain an overall balance of power. That's in your interest, because not because you're doing us a favor. It's in your own interest because this is one of the most fast-growing, economically prosperous parts of the world. And you want to be part of it, right? And so you maintain the balance of power and we help you facilitate that by, for example, giving you access to our facilities in Singapore, your military access to our facilities in Singapore. And the other thing we expect from you, which is also in interest, is to sell us, not give us, certain kinds of technologically advanced weapons that a small country needs to maintain deterrence. So those are two very fundamental common interests. And it's common interest. It helps because we both have, at least in certain cases, the similar interpretation of some of the rules. For example, the rules governing freedom of navigation through international waterways. But it's not essential.
So one major international waterway is the Taiwan Strait, and you had quite a bit to say about the Taiwan situation in your foreign affairs article. And you were critical of the Biden administration or Joe Biden's personal unambiguous statements supporting Taiwan for basically giving Taiwan maybe a sense of entitlement, you called it, and maybe even reinforcing their assessment of their own strategic significance. And it's interesting that we're having this discussion because as we are, Elbridge Colby was up on the Hill today.
I saw that too.
His testimony, and he said that Taiwan is not an existential issue for the United States, and he called upon Taiwan to commit 10% of its GDP to its defense. So are you and Elbridge Colby aligned on this?
Well, I would not say I know Elbridge, right? I would say this. I'll put it this way. I was in Taiwan last year for a visit, and I was a little bit disturbed, and everybody kept quoting what Joe Biden said four times to me. And they didn't seem to listen when I told them each of those four times, his officials qualified what he said. Right? And I kind of said that no matter what happened, this was before the election, before your election. And I kind of said, no matter what happens, Joe Biden ain't going to be the next president of the United States, you know? Right? I actually thought Trump would probably win. But you know, they wouldn't listen, or they didn't want to listen, or they pretended not to listen. And I thought that was a bit dangerous. Because I think Taiwan should spend more on its defense, but I think you are a military officer. You know that it's not a matter of just the budget, it's what you spend it on. And many people have told me they are not spending it or not enough of their budget on the right stuff. Now, the other factor that has come to pass, and we see it playing it out now, in the legislative one, the Taiwan legislature, parliament, they are playing political games with the Taiwanese military budget. That does not give anybody a great sense of confidence in your will to defend yourself. I think everybody would agree with me, because many opinion polls, for what it's worth, support this. There's very little support in Taiwan for the two extremes of either reunification with China or unilateral independence. Everybody more or less wants the status quo to continue. But it is disturbing if you think the status quo is going to continue without me doing something to ensure it continues. Right? Now, that's my concern. If you just focus on what Joe Biden says, Joe Biden was the exception since 1979 when the U.S. established diplomatic relations formally with China. Is the exception, not the norm. Mr. Trump and Mr. Elbridge Colby, they are closer to what was the norm over those years. Because what does the Taiwan Relations Act commit the U.S. to? It commits the U.S. to sell arms to Taiwan. It does not commit the U.S. to defend Taiwan. That is a political decision that you will make depending on the circumstances. It's situational and conditional. I think if China unprovoked attacks Taiwan, that's one situation. If Taiwan does something to invite an attack, I don't think it's very probable, but let's say unilaterally declares independence, that's another situation. So I think I was a bit concerned last year when I went there, and I kept hearing over and over again Mr. Biden being quoted. And when I kind of pointed out he's always been qualified by his own guys, people didn't seem to register that bit.
So I guess the paradigm shift is, for all these years, the U.S. has provided a common good of the counterbalancing factor. So the cop on the beat. Now you see that ending, and who can step up to play that role?
First of all, I don't see it ending, regardless of Mr. Trump, right? Mr. Trump doesn't like wars. Who likes wars? But I think he understands that the Asia-Pacific or the Indo-Pacific is important, and the U.S. has to be there. As long as you are there in military force, there is a balance of power. And there is no combination of countries without the U.S. that can provide that balance. But I'm pretty confident that you will provide that balance in your own interest. You will be there. The Seventh Fleet will be there. Or no, it's not. Is it called the Seventh Fleet or the Indo-Pacific Fleet? Right? Indo-Pacific Command. It will be there, right? Sorry, I'm betraying my age. I think you will be there in your interest. Now, you may not get involved if there is, let's say, a skirmish over Second Thomas Shoal or Scarborough Shoal or something. You may not want to get involved. That's a different issue, but you will be there. As long as you are there and you have a treaty commitment to Japan over the senkakus, I think there will be an overall balance. And you're not doing this as a favor to Japan or to Singapore or to ASEAN or to anybody. You're doing this in your own interest. But we have to do our part. I mean, I think one very big difference between East Asia, at least, or Indo-Pacific, and Europe, for example, we have never underinvested in our defense. We have never underinvested our defense because we never believed that there was a big peace dividend after the end of the Cold War. Right? And the reason we didn't believe that is the reason I gave you before, because all the challenges that face us are hard power challenges. And you can only meet hard power with hard power.
Well, so one of the points that you are pains to make in your article is that actually you see a continuity between the approach of Richard Nixon to Asia and that of Donald Trump in terms of, you know, putting America's interests first and trying to sort of make the best deal that you can to sort of extract America from undue commitments. Obviously, there are a lot of mixed feelings about Richard Nixon as well as Donald Trump in the United States for various reasons. But can you talk about, you seem to indicate that you think that the Richard Nixon, Donald Trump sort of pragmatism, if you will, or transactionalism is more in line with general American foreign policy, and that some of the things that we've been sort of involved with in recent times have been more of the aberration?
I think so. The historical analogy is not exact, of course. Historical analogies are never exact, but they're still useful. By the way, I should say that if I was an American, I would probably be upset about Richard Nixon and Donald Trump, but I'm not American, okay? So that's my basic premise. So I look basically at foreign policy rather than domestic policy, okay? As part of rectifying a mistake that the U.S. made on the mainland of Southeast Asia, in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, Richard Nixon shifted the basic strategic approach of America to East Asia, at least, from one of direct intervention to being offshore balancer. Right? Because it was a realization not only that the Vietnam War was not winnable, but it was not necessary to win it. Because there was the Vietnam War was mistakenly seen as a kind of existential move, a threat, a move by international communism, whatever that meant, on the global stage. Whereas it actually was a civil war between two variants of Vietnamese nationalism, right? So that is nasty. It is very important to the Vietnamese, but why should Americans care if it is not an existential threat? So Richard Nixon shifted the basic strategic posture. No more direct intervention, but offshore balancing. I'll provide the overall nuclear umbrella for the whole region, right? And it has helped. Whenever people tell me America is inconstant, unreliable, I said yes, because you change everything every 4 years. But in this respect, you have been very constant for 50 years. Right, acting as offshore balancer. And because of what I said, because you face no existential threat anywhere in the world, this is going to be the future of American foreign policy. It is not a retreat, but it's going to be, you're going to be far more discriminating about whether and how you get involved in any region of the world. Now, that is, I think, fundamentally Donald Trump's approach. He's not an isolationist. Look what he has done or said on Panama, on Greenland, even on Canada. Now, those are not statements of an isolationist, right? Whether he means it or not is another issue, right? But, you know, but those are not statements of an isolationist. But, you know, it's the statements of that he has a particular view of the world. I don't wish to commit troops because why should I? But doesn't mean I don't have any interest. And I have a big stick. I love brandishing it, and I so far, at least, I got my way. Now, that kind of very transactional approach aligns to what I said also, that Asia, generally speaking, has dealt with the U.S. much more on the basis of common interests rather than common values. That aligns more neatly with Mr. Trump's approach than any other approach. In other words, if you want us to do something, we will calculate the costs and benefits. And if it's something that only America can do, right, we'll do it. If it's something that where American participation is kind of optional, then we'll calculate the costs and benefits of whether we want to get involved. Now, in this respect, I keep telling people, Mr. Biden is extremely consultative. But he was not consulting anybody. Hey, how's your family doing? You know, how's the son, the daughter? Have they graduated yet? He's consulting you to see what you were prepared to do to help him advance American interests. That's why I call it polite transactions. Where Mr. Trump differs sharply is he thinks America has no need to be polite. And unfortunately, he may not be wrong. Look, Europe is incapable of deterring Russia without the US at its back. And having the US's back will come at a price. Only part of the price has been revealed so far. You better spend more on your own defense. Asia, all combination of Asian allies and friends, are incapable of balancing China without the US at our back. And that will come at a price too. And since in this particular case, it is indispensable, we'll just have to pay the price or find a way.
So the price is likely to be on trade, right? It's going to be...
Price is on trade, then okay.
He's going to ask for trade remedies to correct the trade deficits the U.S. runs with most of Asia.
To buy more. Well, Singapore, you have a trade surplus with Singapore. Anyway, we are a small player in this respect, right? But for people with large deficit, with large surpluses with the United States, that means where the U.S. runs big deficits with those countries, they will have to buy more. And they have already begun to say so. Taiwan has just announced a huge new investment by TSMC, right? I think the Ishiba, when he met Trump, promised to buy more LNG and other things. And you're going to see more of that. And good. I mean, we're not going to buy things that we don't need, but America has a lot of things that we do need.
So, given Trump's impolite style, as you might say, does impoliteness not carry a cost when dealing with Asian leaders? Or is it simply that Asian leaders are savvy enough to know how to talk to Donald Trump in a way that he doesn't sort of veer into the impolite sort of style that he has with European leaders?
I think Europe, every American president since Bill Clinton, post-Cold War, has told Europe more or less the same thing. You need to spend more on your own defense. Stop free riding. But most have been so polite that the Europeans just disregarded the whole thing. Donald Trump got their attention. And I think most Asian leaders will take a lesson from that meeting with Mr. Zelensky. Was it 28th of February? Yeah, 28th of February. Where I think I saw the clip, right? I've never seen a press conference take place in the Oval Office, or very seldom. I can't recall one, right? And this was a very long press conference, about almost an hour, if I'm not mistaken. Right? Normally, you go outside to the Rose Garden, there are two rostrums, your president makes a statement, the visitor makes a statement, you take a couple of questions and it's over, very scripted. I think Mr. Zelensky was ambushed. Right? And, you know, and it was, I understand and I sympathize with him for losing his temper. But it was baited. It was baited to lose his temper, and people should take a lesson from that. And I think we will.
Do you see an opening for China and Trump to make some sort of grand bargain?
No, I don't think they're going to make deals. Huh? Mr. Trump is a deal maker to the marrow of his bones, and he believes there's no one better at it, right? But if you're talking about grand bargain where you throw trade, you throw Taiwan, you throw South China Sea, East China Sea into a basket, I don't think that is very... I can't say it will never happen, but I think it is highly improbable for a very simple reason. Mr. Trump loves to make deals. He thinks he's the best at it. But much as he loves to make deals, he loves to win and be seen to win much better, much more. That's very important to him. Now, if we make a grand bargain that will, in effect, concede East Asia to China, it's going to be seen as a clear lose for America. And Trump doesn't want to be seen as a loser, particularly not one that was bamboozled by China. So I think that's not. I think he will more likely make deals with China on trade, on trade-related issues, and then present them as huge wins. Right? I think we shouldn't prejudge it. At least I don't prejudge it, because there may be opportunities for Singapore and other countries in those deals. We shouldn't say that those deals are necessarily going to... Those deals will be based on the principle of putting America first. That's for sure. Right? But I don't prejudge it that means it's necessarily bad for the rest of us. In those deals, there could be opportunities. I don't know what they are because we don't know what those deals are right now. But let's not prejudge the issue. Wait and see.
Well, Bilahari Kaskhan, I cannot let you go without asking you about ASEAN, because you have the greatest ASEAN quote I have ever heard. And that is the one in which you talk about the fact that ASEAN is not a horse, it's a cow. And that a cow is a very useful animal, but we should stop trying to expect it to be a horse. So I'm going to ask you two things. What did you mean then that ASEAN is not a horse, but a cow? And how do you look at it today with what ASEAN is trying to do? Do you think that ASEAN is still trying to act like a horse, or do you think that, or people are expecting ASEAN to be a horse? Is ASEAN a horse or a cow?
Well, what I said really is that it's utterly pointless to criticize a cow for being an imperfect horse. Right? Now, ASEAN has two fundamental purposes. The basic and enduring purpose, which it does pretty well, is to manage relations among its members, to ensure at least a basic level of stability and stability in bilateral relationships in a region where neither stability nor civility should be taken for granted. It does that pretty well, and it has transformed Southeast Asia. But a secondary purpose, it's always been secondary, is to conduct international relations on the part for the region as a whole. Now, international relations, whether they are defense relations or foreign policy relations, have always been primarily a national responsibility and only secondarily a regional responsibility. ASEAN is a supplement to what each country does by itself. On that second point, there was a lot of expectation, including among some ASEAN members, that we could gallop like a horse. I think there was always a bit of a delusion, right? And and that has come home. I think one point that I should make, I'm of the view that, competition among major powers, and therefore at least the possibility of conflict, these are inherent characteristics of international relations. But that harsh truth about international relations was masked by a historically short and exceptional period of time, less than 20 years or so, between, 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, and 2008 or thereabouts, when the global financial crisis broke out. And all of ASEAN's major international forums and institutions were crafted and put into operation during that short exceptional period, where it is the ASEAN Regional Forum, the East Asia Summit, the ASEAN Defense Ministers Plus meeting. So they had a use then when we thought great power competition was muted. So the great powers found these institutions fairly useful enough to help to supplement how they advance their interests in Southeast Asia, but not so strong that they could stymie any vital interests of the major powers. Now, that period is over, and we haven't adapted fast enough. ASEAN likes to call itself central, right? We are central. Before we called ourselves central, we used to say that ASEAN should be in the driver's seat. And then some wise guy pointed out that the person in the driver's seat is sometimes only the chauffeur. And then we started using the term centrality. Okay. Now, what does centrality mean? Centrality means, in its essence, making yourself useful. You can't be central if you are not useful. You have to be useful to your members. You have to be useful to your partners. We are still central as far as our membership is concerned, but we are less central as far as our partners are concerned because we have not adapted fast enough to the changes in the strategic environment. Right? I mean, of course, people will still come at some level and, you know, attend our meetings and so on, if only not to allow their rivals to steal a march on them. But that doesn't mean that you are really central. They may be polite enough to call you central, but you shouldn't be foolish enough to believe them. You have to do something to make yourself useful.
Lightning round exit question for you then. Will there ever be an ASEAN-China code of conduct on the South China Sea?
Maybe my great-grandchildren will see one. And even if there's one, it's not going to be legally binding.
All right. Well, then, Bilahari Kauskan, you have been a wonderful guest. We thank you for joining us today, and we do hope to have you on again soon.
Thank you for inviting me. I hope what I said was good enough for you, but not so provocative to lose your readership.
Thank you very much, sir. And our podcast, as always, is sponsored by Bauer Group Asia, a strategic advisory firm that specializes in the Indo-Pacific. Bauer Group applies unmatched expertise and experience to help clients navigate the world's most complex and dynamic markets. My co-host, Jim Crusoe, is a senior advisor with Bauer Group, and you can find them at their website, bauergroupasia.com. Well, Jim, I have always wanted to talk to Bilahari, just because, if for nothing else, because of that wonderful quote he has about ASEAN, because I think it's just so descriptive. And he does have a way with words. He has a way of just sort of putting things in perspective. And as we're having this conversation right now, it's early March, as he indicated in the discussion, we had just wrapped up this very dramatic meeting in the Oval Office with Volodymyr Zelensky. And I will say that amongst many of us who watch foreign policy very closely, there has been a fair amount of catastrophizing about the direction that we seem to be headed. But he definitely has a much more nuanced view on all of that.
Well, he does. He has a sort of traditionalist view of foreign policy and international relations from the old Athenian Thucydides line about great powers do what they want and great little powers suffer what they must. And he basically thinks we're back to that. So it's sort of, all right, now we got to deal with that.
Well, for those of us who relish the idea that, you know, the country that we serve for so long is a force for good, and we want to see them do good, right, moral things all over the place. Yeah, that's not really music to our ears, right? We want to feel like we're always out there, you know, standing up for the little guy, standing up for the rules-based order, all of these things that we love. And I kind of want to think that we're still going to keep doing that. It may just be in the face of some very strange rhetoric.
Well, it'd be nice if we started aid again. And I would argue that aid helps create more stability in countries. Stability is good for a power like ours, which likes things pretty much as they are. Dealing with allies and partners in the way that they are want to work with us. I think after 9/11, what was the only time the NATO Article 5 was implemented? After 9/11, when the European countries and others said, we're going to go defend the United States. We've never had to do that. Now, if we're throwing all that away, we're on our own.
Yeah.
So that's my problem.
Yeah. I tried to sort of take deep breaths after each of these things, right? And, you know, recall that, you know, the arc of history does not go in a straight line. It moves back and forth over time. And so we're in a particular moment, and some parts of this particular moment may actually, we may look back and say, actually, you know, some of these things were necessary. Maybe we don't like the way that they happened, but the fact that they happened, some of them may have actually, you know, been things that needed to happen. So, you know, maybe we did need to sort of take a hard look at where the aid was going and how it was getting out. Maybe we did need to take a look at, you know, the kinds of assurances we were giving, and were they leading our allies and partners into complacency? Now, I will say I'm not a fan of roller coasters, and that seems to be what we're on right now.
Well, also, if this is a true paradigm shift, if we're really going to change how international relations are conducted and the role of the United States in the world, historically, when there's a paradigm shift, that's not a good time, because the great powers are out there saying, oh, well, how far can I stretch my elbows now? And little powers are trying to figure out what their roles are. And things, more often than not historically, go bad. So I'm just hoping we're not in that period.
All right. Well, so that we do not end on that note, you need to tell me a story.
Well, it's not so much a story as the fact that Bilahari, you all have to do is say the name Bilahari, and it's like saying Cher to diplomats.
He sings?
He doesn't sing, but you heard him. He speaks in poetry. And everyone wants to go see Bilahari. If they go through Singapore, every American diplomat, every foreign diplomat. And it's also amazing to me that this little country of, 3 million people has such outsized influence, whether it's Lee Kuan Yew being the great wise man of Asia, who American presidents would go and seek his advice. Secretaries of State would go see people like Bilahari. It's an amazing testament to the serious thinking that goes on when you are little and have to really think deep thoughts to figure out how you're going to navigate the world. Maybe that's why he's not so worried.
And a little country that has done it with such astonishing success.
Yes. I would note their GDP per capita is higher than ours.
I could margin.
Yes.
All right. Well, Jim Caruso, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And it's always a pleasure to see our producer, Ian Ellis Jones. We thank him and IEJ Media for producing our podcast. And we congratulate Ian on yet again getting lots and lots of attention from some of his recent geopolitical graphics that he's been putting out on the Taiwan situation. So congratulations, Ian. You can follow him and see all those cool graphics at Ian Ellis Jones on X. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you should subscribe and follow. You should certainly go back and listen, because we talked about Elbridge Colby and his recent testimony. We did, in fact, interview Elbridge Colby last year during episode 11, Why Should We Care About America's Defense Priorities? So if you're interested in what the number 3 person nominated for the Pentagon thinks about America's defense priorities, you should go back and listen to episode 11. You can certainly follow us on social media, X, Blue Sky, LinkedIn, YouTube, all of that stuff. And you should email us if you have specific things that you'd like us to respond to. IndoPacificPodcast@gmail.com. Of course, as always, we want to thank our great sponsors at Bauer Group Asia. Visit them at BauerGroupAsia.com. Tell them that we sent you so that they will continue to sponsor your favorite podcast. Jim, Ian, it's Ray. Thanks, guys. Talk to you soon.